This is the Past Lives Podcast, episode 250, and I'm your host, Simon Bowen. My mission here at Past Lives Podcast is to investigate evidence that demonstrates survival of the human soul. We will look at past life memories, near-death experiences, spirit communication, and other incredible phenomena. And please look out for the Past Lives Podcast episodes called Paranormal Stories, and they're released every Thursday. And if you want to hear the extended version of this episode, please join the Patreon campaign. And this week, I'm talking to Jeffrey Long, MD, about his Bigelow Institute for Consciousness Studies winning essay. It's called Evidence for Survival of Consciousness in Near-Death Experiences, Decades of Science and New Insights. Jeffrey Long is a medical doctor specializing in the practice of radiation oncology, using radiation to treat cancer. As a scientist, Jeff founded NDERF in 1998. As a result of his research, he is the author of the New York Times bestseller, Evidence of the Afterlife, The Science of Near-Death Experiences, and he also wrote God and the Afterlife, the groundbreaking new evidence for God and near-death experience. As a leading NDE researcher and medical doctor, Jeff has appeared on national media including O'Reilly Factor, NBC Today, ABC with Peter Jennings, The Dr. Oz Show, The History Channel, The Learning Channel, and National Geographic. He has also appeared on Fox News Houston and at the New York Academy of Sciences. Hi, Jeff. Thanks a lot for coming onto the podcast.
It's a pleasure to be here. We've got a lot to talk about, Simon.
I've read your essay that was a prize winner with the Bigelow Essay Contest. It's called Evidence for Survival of Consciousness in Near-Death Experiences, Decades of Science and New Insights, and it's just a fascinating read. But you are a physician yourself, aren't you? And you practice in radiation oncology?
That is correct. I'm a full-time physician. Practicing keeps me busy. Radiation oncology is the use of radiation to treat cancer, and certainly do that and also research near-death experiences.
Have you ever had something happen in your department with a patient telling you they've had an experience?
Yeah, that happens periodically. It's either a patient or, interestingly, a family member will describe a near-death experience or a near-death experience that occurred in a friend or family member that's not with them when they talk with me. So we see that periodically, and they, you know, needless to say, when they find out that I'm an expert in near-death experiences, that leads to an awful lot of discussion.
Yeah, I can imagine. I suppose it's like when somebody finds out somebody's a medium, straight away they start coming out with those type of stories.
Oh, absolutely. And it's really great for patient rapport too. People that have near-death experiences generally recognize the experience is extremely important, typically very life-changing. So to be able to talk to a doctor who's knowledgeable about it and obviously very open to it as I am, really helps me to establish rapport with patients and form that much stronger of a physician-patient bond.
I suppose the patients have different view of illness and their prognosis if they know about this stuff.
Absolutely. People that have near-death experiences, the overwhelming majority no longer fear death and believe in an afterlife. So certainly those patients that have had near-death experiences are able to face that diagnosis of cancer with more courage and more awareness that their physical life death won't be the end, but beyond that will be an afterlife, a wonderful afterlife. So certainly that helps them. It may not help their family members so much. I mean, you really have to experience a near-death experience to really have, typically to have all the life changes and changes in beliefs and understanding about life and death that people that have a near-death experience have.
So was there a specific thing that convinced you of survival after death? Was it like a eureka moment, or was it a slow, gradual process?
Yeah, it was. I started out my research over 20 years ago as basically a skeptic. I'd read an article about near-death experience in a very prominent medical journal and was fascinated. I was in my residency training at that time, training to be a radiation oncologist. And so several years later, when I had a college friend come to town with his wife, and his wife over supper described a very detailed near-death experience, I was really hooked. And upon hearing that and having read very little bit about it, I realized if near-death experiences are for real, this, as I conceptualized at the time, this changes my view of the universe that we live in. So I started a website basically as a skeptic, going to the original source of evidence, not what other people had published. This was even pre-strong internet over 20 years ago. But I wanted to go to the original source of evidence, that being people that had near-death experiences, fill out an online questionnaire and see for myself. And the eureka moment came after I downloaded my first several dozen very first responses to the survey I had posted. And immediately I recognized that near-death experiences are, in a word, real. Over and over was tremendous consistency, details that were medically inexplicable. And I realized very quickly, near-death experiences are the real thing. And of course, now that I've studied over 4,000, that initial impression that I had is certainly far more ingrained than it was back in the early months of doing this research.
So can you tell us about the Near-Death Experience Research Foundation?
Sure. Over 20 years ago, that was the foundation I established to study near-death experiences. I wanted to use the best scientific methodology that was available. And so we used the best survey questions that we could find, and we posted them on the internet. Now, fortunately, subsequent research has validated that internet surveys are as valid as the traditional pencil and paper, if you will, surveys. So we're quite confident with the validity of this type of research and other researchers that use internet-based surveys. But anyway, right off the bat, we started with a very detailed survey, and I noted immediately, realized that near-death experiences were extraordinary and certainly medically inexplicable. But I'll refer to it in this podcast as NDERF, standing for the Near-Death Experience Research Foundation. So that became what just started out as simply a, basically, if you will, a skeptic I was at that time to come to understand NDEs, blossomed into a tremendous research project where we now have over 4,000 near-death experiences. My wife, even though she's a licensed attorney, her full-time job is now to serve as webmaster, and Jody has single-handedly translated the NDERF website into over 30 different languages. So as a result, we're a huge international outreach and able to do by far the largest cross-cultural study of near-death experience ever reported.
People can log in and just read these near-death experiences, can't they?
Oh, absolutely, Simon. And that's a really good point. At NDERF is by far the largest collection of publicly accessible full-text near-death experiences in the world, with over 4,000 posted and literally thousands of other related types of experiences. Jody and I believe that this is a public service, and that which was shared freely with us on our NDERF website, we really are obligated morally to share it freely with the world. And that's been our philosophy for over 20 years. If you go there, you'll quickly realize we don't have anything for sale and we don't look for donations. Our job is to just simply to share with the world the truth about near-death experiences with huge numbers as accurately and reliably as any source on the planet.
And I'll put a link to the website in the show notes for this episode as well.
I appreciate that.
One thing that always stands out to me with near-death experiences, the one thing that really validates them for me, is when people see something when they're having an out-of-body experience, and then later it's verified, and people would say, well, you couldn't have seen that. We were resuscitating. Your brain was dead.
That's absolutely correct. There's many lines of evidence in near-death experience that all converge on the reality of near-death experiences, but one of the strongest is exactly what you just said there. We call that the out-of-body experience, and about 45% of people that have a near-death experience will have their consciousness separate from their body, typically going above their physical body. From that vantage point, they can see and often hear ongoing earthly events, often including people desperately trying to bring them back to life. I mean, don't forget, they're clinically unconscious or dead with absent heartbeat at this point in time. And yet here they are, as you've noted, with highly lucid awareness of ongoing events. And I studied about 280 of these out-of-body experiences and found that they were accurate down to the finest detail. No inaccuracy at all, either by my assessment or by the assessment of the near-death experiencer that was sharing it with us. So, and other researchers, again, have found extremely high reliability, again, down to the finest details. And you know what's remarkable, Simon, is that even when people are observing events, when they're in that out-of-body experience, geographically far from their physical body and far outside of any physical sensory awareness, what they're seeing and hear when they check it out later after they recover from what nearly killed them is almost invariably accurate down to the finest detail. There's absolutely no way they could have seen events a block away, miles away, as we have a fairly large series of near-death experiencers that have reported.
And was it Dr. Sabom who asked patients about their own resuscitations, and he also had a control group?
That's an excellent point. Interestingly, it was Dr. Sabom's article in the Journal of the American Medical Association was the very first article I ever read about near-death experience and first became aware of it. And indeed, just like you said, Dr. Sabom is a cardiologist, and so obviously he deals with people that whose heart stops and need resuscitated. And his study of people describing their own resuscitation found that if they had a near-death experience and had that out-of-body experience and actually observed their own resuscitation, they were extremely accurate down to the finest details. The control group, those that had a cardiac arrest, were resuscitated but did not have a near-death experience, could only make wild guesses about what happened or talk about what they thought happened based on their knowledge from television shows or other media events, and it was wildly inaccurate. So again, some of the earliest evidence corroborating many other researchers' findings that what you see and heard in out-of-body experiences during near-death experience is absolutely for real.
And what sort of percentage of near-death experiences are able to give this level of detail that's verified?
Right. About, as I mentioned, about 45% of people during their near-death experience see and hear ongoing earthly events. The remaining 55% don't see or hear ongoing earthly events. They pass very quickly into what could be described as unearthly realms or into or through a tunnel, and they're not making observations of ongoing earthly events. So it's nearly half. So we have, you know, out of 4,000 near-death experiences that we have posted on the NDERF website, I mean, that's literally close to well over 1,500 that have described these out-of-body experiences that, with ongoing earthly event observations. And again, it is so overwhelmingly consistent that what they see and hear in that out-of-body experience is real that as a researcher, I'm actually far more fascinated with these rare near-death experiences where what they see or hear is not real. And I would emphasize that's rare. My research, current batch of NDEs we see, that's less than a percent or two.
So you talk about the NDE scale in the essay. What is the NDE scale?
The NDE scale is the most validated research scale to help determine if an experience is a near-death experience or is not a near-death experience. It was founded several decades ago by the leading NDE researcher, Dr. Bruce Grayson, and he developed 16 questions, and the questions would sort of, one, there were three responses possible for each question, and they found that you had to have a score of 7 to have the experience be considered a near-death experience by this research scale. The scale and the three responses for each of the 16 questions, one of the responses is always no, that a particular element didn't exist, and then the other two responses are increasingly detailed manifestation of that particular characteristic.
There's a title of one of the sections of the essay, which is The Medically Inexplicable Consciousness of Near-Death Experiences. And this is when people are still conscious, but medically they shouldn't be at all. Maybe their brain is flatlined?
Right. When we say that consciousness is apart from the body, there's a survey question where I ask their degree of consciousness and alertness in that out-of-body state compared to their earthly everyday consciousness. And about 3/4 of people that have a near-death experience say that consciousness, when it's apart from the body, is more conscious, more alert than what they knew during their earthly everyday life. And again, sometimes I almost have to pinch myself. These are people that at that time are physically, their physical body is unconscious or clinically dead. Same survey question, about 20% of people that have a near-death experience say their consciousness and alertness during their near-death experience is equivalent to what they experienced in their physical earthly life. And it's only 5% of people having a near-death experience saying that they were less conscious and alert during their near-death experience. So this is all, again, very strong evidence that the consciousness that separates from the physical body is actually supernormal consciousness. People are thinking more clearly. They're aware of things more clearly. Just as a vivid example, about 20% of people that have near-death experiences have what's called a life review. They may see part or even all of their prior life and review it, and review it in detail, often described as seeing it on a movie screen is a common description of it, although it can be varied in how they have their life review. But good gosh, think about this, Simon. Here you have people unconscious or clinically dead, you know, until they're recovered, typically minutes, you know, 5-10 minutes. And yet here they are reviewing typically decades of their prior life in detail with all events reviewed. That's a vivid example of how accelerated consciousness can be during near-death experiences.
And also you talk about how it's doubly inexplicable if somebody's under general anesthesia as well as having a cardiac arrest.
Oh, absolutely. Under adequate general anesthesia, and of course, as a doctor, I know that. I did an anesthesia rotation. When you're under adequate anesthesia, typically we even have to breathe for you. I mean, you're shut down, not just in terms of your ability to have a conscious cortical brain memory or experience, but you're shut down so much we typically have to artificially ventilate these patients because they're shut down to the brainstem level. That part of even the brainstem that controls breathing is suppressed by the anesthetic agents. So these people are beyond unconscious when they're under anesthesia. They're literally comatose. And of course, at a time of general anesthesia, they very carefully monitor heart function. That's a part of the anesthesiologist's job. And so when a heartbeat stops during anesthesia, when they code, if you will, that's extremely well documented. So we have scores of near-death experiences that occurred while under general anesthesia. And again, we talked about that out-of-body experience. They often vividly describe the frantic efforts of the surgical team and anesthesiologists to try to bring them back to life. What they describe is, I will tell you as a doctor, what really happens when you code unexpectedly during an operation. It's not like in the movies where the crash cart mysteriously disappears or mysteriously is there, appears, and everybody works swiftly and professionally. I mean, in the real world, there's panic. There may be unprofessional behavior, which is often the doctor's. There can be tears. I mean, there can be, it's a horrible experience for the whole operating room team there. And that's what near-death experiencers almost uniformly describe when they have that out-of-body experience and observe what their own body being resuscitated while they're under general anesthesia. And in fact, just to run with that example, we presented on TV a person who had a near-death experience, coded, heart stopped while they were under anesthesia. Their consciousness separated from their body in that out-of-body experience, but then their consciousness drifted into the hospital cafeteria, far obviously from their physical body. And from that vantage point, he saw his family sitting at a table eating, talking away, unaware of that life-threatening event going on in another part of the hospital. So when he recovered from that close brush with death, he found that what he saw and heard of his family talking was absolutely accurate down to the finest details. Again, absolutely beyond any possible medical explanation.
Was there also somebody who came out of their body during the operation and the doctor received the wrong tool and he threw it on the floor?
Yeah, you're not supposed to do that. That's a huge breach of medical practice. And someone actually, and that's a good point, that's a near-death experience where the doctor didn't like the tool he was handed and threw it on the floor, which is inappropriate. And that's unprofessional and certainly highly unexpected. That's a good example that during these out-of-body experiences, including when they're under general anesthesia, they may see events going on that they would have never guessed were even possible. We had one person with a near-death experience, for example, who saw the doctor sort of flapping his arms sort of like wings. And he came back and described that and said, well, what the heck was that all about? And it turned out the doctor was actually doing that, trying to very quickly dry off his gloves, and that was a habit the doctor had, which the patient who had the near-death experience could not possibly have otherwise known.
Hello listeners, this is Simon. Now, some of you know I have a diploma in clinical hypnotherapy and I'm certified in past life regression therapy. And in the past few weeks, I've taken many clients through some amazing and healing past life regressions. And I conduct sessions over Zoom and I've had clients from many countries around the world. Now, when you go through a past life regression, you will feel totally in control and remember everything. And also, I record the whole session and send you an MP3 afterwards. And this gives you space to relax and go with the flow, knowing that you can listen back later and analyse what you experienced if you need to. So if you ever wanted to explore your past lives in a single session or have an issue you want to work on, you can go to my website at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk and book a free 20-minute consultation. And at the moment, I'm offering a 25% discount to everyone that has signed up to the Patreon campaign. The link is in the show notes. And also, I suppose some skeptics might say that you have a near-death experience because you're so full of painkillers and things that you're just hallucinating. But under general anesthesia, you don't even dream, do you?
Yeah, no, you don't. My gosh, you're shut down, as I mentioned, even to the brainstem level. In the mercifully extremely rare events of this so-called anesthetic awareness where they're too light in anesthesia, they don't have anything like a near-death experience. By far the most common sensation is sound. They hear things while in their physical body, and certainly it hurts. And I want to emphasize for the reassurance of all listeners, that is extraordinarily rare, especially with modern anesthetic. You virtually never hear about it. But again, even erroneously or inappropriately light anesthesia doesn't produce any. That's been well described in the medical literature, obviously, because as physicians, we try to minimize the risk of that happening, and that so-called anesthetic awareness is nothing like a near-death experience in any way.
And so how many times do you hear of people who are really quite ill and they have a near-death experience, or they might be very badly hurt when they have the near-death experience, like an accident, but then they have some kind of miraculous recovery?
You know, that's interesting, Simon. As a physician, I'm very interested in that. They're very uncommon in near-death experiences where there seems to be during the NDE itself, they become aware that they are being healed, typically by unearthly, if you will, spiritual beings. And that's communicated very clearly. When that happens, these people do seem to have, if you will, I hate to use the term miracle, but I can't think of any better word for many of the near-death experiences that have been shared where their healing and cure is absolutely defies anything I can tell as a physician from reading their account. I mean, it shouldn't happen. It's literally a miracle. And they're often told that by other doctors there too. For instance, there was a child who had had a very bad, I believe it was a lymphoma, and it had spread throughout their body. And this young child failed multiple rounds of chemotherapy, which, especially in that era decades ago, is means you're not going to cure it. And the patient had bulky disease all through their belly and were undergoing emergency surgery. And you can tell as a doctor, that means they're just trying to palliate this person. There's no chance you're going to be cured. And you're certainly not going to give chemotherapy around the time of a surgery or risk an infection. And yet during the near-death experience, this person was aware that they were going to be cured. And when they returned, all their lymphoma very rapidly went away. And that is, and the best word in the English language is miracle.
And didn't Dr. Eben Alexander, he had terrible meningitis on his brain, didn't he, that should have caused long-term damage?
Oh, absolutely. Eben Alexander, who wrote Proof of Heaven, was a Harvard neurosurgeon who had a very severe episode of meningitis. Interestingly, I saw the CT, the CAT scan of his brain when the meningitis was active, while the two of us were on the Dr. Oz show. And there it was on a big screen. I hadn't seen it before. I looked up and, here we're on national TV, and yet it was hard for me to avoid shuddering as I saw that CAT scan displayed a horrible, all the every bit of his meninges brightly lit from infection. I recognized a physician that's a death sentence. And I had to quickly try to catch my breath and calm myself down for the national show we were doing. But yeah, I've seen that. And there's no way you should come back from that. I mean, that is literally a death sentence to have meningitis that severe. And yet recover he did, and had a very vivid near-death experience. And I've heard him talk about that. We've shared shows before. A stunningly detailed near-death experience with a lot of the bells and whistles of the deeper accounts. And Eben Alexander and what he has to share about it is definitely worth either watching it as a video or hearing it as an audio request if you listeners ever have a chance.
With the condition his brain was in with that illness, even if he recovered, he shouldn't have recovered as well as he has, should he?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's first of all, that we're getting back to that term of miracle for recovery. But even in the event you do, when you have that horrific of meningitis, you should be impaired for life. I mean, potentially even a vegetable. So for him to recover fully and he's a remarkably lucid, brilliant speaker, for him to recover after that horrific meningitis is absolutely astounding.
So there are lots of people who come very close to death and they resuscitated and they don't report any near-death experience. Do you think maybe they do have one, they just don't remember it, or they just don't get one?
Yeah, about 10 to 20% of people who nearly die have a near-death experience. Interestingly, one study found the closer to death you are, the more likely you are to have a near-death experience, which is contrary to what the skeptics would think. But I even co-authored a scholarly book chapter where we reviewed several decades of prior research in an effort to discern, among other issues, can we tell who will and who will not have a near-death experience when they nearly die? And the bottom line is we couldn't when we wrote that book chapter a good many years ago. However, subsequently, many theories have come up. Certainly, there are those that say, well, maybe they had one and they don't remember it. That's certainly a possibility. We have another sort of working hypothesis that I have about why 80 or 90% of people don't have near-death experiences with that close brush with death. And that was shared to me not by another researcher, but by a person who had a near-death experience themselves. And in this near-death experience, they were feeling overwhelming bliss and peace and overwhelming love way beyond anything they could have known in their earthly life, which, by the way, is quite common in near-death experiences. And this person was in the presence of God, which, again, is common, circa 15-20% of the time, which she identified as God. And she was having such an overwhelmingly positive near-death experience, she asked God directly, why me? Why am I so special that this should happen to me? And I think God's response may have answered why some have NDEs and some don't. God said to her, everyone is special. Love falls on everyone equally. This is what you needed to live your earthly life. And as soon as I read that, I went, that was my big aha moment. I said, I get it. Why some have near-death experiences and why some don't is not really a medical or physiologic determination, but its determination is made, or basically NDEs are co-created by basically the wisdom on the other side in the afterlife. And some people need near-death experiences and it's important to live their earthly life. And apparently a lot of people don't need near-death experience. So that's my working hypothesis at this time.
It's almost like the spirit world's looking down at you and they see you and they think, oh, we need to have a word with him.
Yeah, I think it's probably way complex. Understand that the beings, God, other beings in the afterlife are overwhelmingly loving and overwhelmingly knowledgeable, vastly beyond anybody on the planet that ever existed in the physical world. So when there's a determination made like that, certainly I don't know that it's unilaterally decided. It may involve the person having that life-threatening event, and that may affect why some have remembrance of a near-death experience and some don't. But I think to some extent, near-death experiences seem to be co-created is the best word I can find. But, understand when they have a near-death experience, they're not, like say when they're in the unearthly or, if you will, heavenly realms, there may be landscapes, buildings, There may be colors beautiful that they have no correlate on Earth, music beautiful beyond anything possible in on the planet. Often deceased beings are there. So it's not like this experience is being created solely by the near-death experiencer. There are other conscious beings around them. Take, for example, deceased loved ones. About 20%, 15-20% of the time they describe that. So these near-death, the deceased loved ones certainly are their own autonomous consciousness beings. I mean, they communicate with the near-death experiencer. There's often a lot of information shared and a lot of loving. So I think the near-death experience is a combination of the consciousness of the near-death experiencer and other conscious entities. And I think that's probably, in the broad sense, explains why some people have near-death experiences and some don't, or at least that may be applicable to some, perhaps many situations where some have NDEs and some don't.
And the spiritual beings, whoever they are, that, say, construct the NDE for the experiencer, they know them so well, they can give them exactly what they need.
Right. And I think that's a lot of truth. And again, the beings on the other side being, thank goodness, they're probably the number one characteristic, if you had to pick one, is that they are overwhelmingly loving. We hear them describe the love they get from these beings on the other side as they're loved completely for all they are, who they are, everything that they are through and through. That's almost an exact statement from a near-death experiencer. So I think when you have that over basically a universe ruled by love and manifest through these conscious beings, it's not surprising that they're going to at least to some extent, with whatever the rules are, have a near-death experience that will be right for the near-death experiencer. And certainly they seem to have some ability to control or affect the environment the near-death experiencer is in, and to some extent the content of the experience.
And sometimes people have quite distressing near-death experiences, and I suppose that's just what they need to help them live their life the way they should be?
That's a really good question. The frightening, when we talk about frightening near-death experiences, I've done a fair amount of investigation into that. There's several different ways a near-death experience can be frightening. It can be subjectively frightening. In other words, they feel fear. And they may feel fear during their near-death experience simply because the experience is so unfamiliar. They typically calm down, or they may just simply feel fear. A good example of a subjective fear in a near-death experience is we had someone code. Their heart stopped. They were in an ambulance being rushed to the hospital, but they had that out-of-body experience we talked about. And this time their consciousness was above the roof of the ambulance, paralleling the journey of the ambulance to the hospital. But while their consciousness was above the ambulance, a number of angels appeared. Now, I think virtually everyone would say, oh, how nice, that's great. But the angels frightened this near-death experiencer, and he batted at them. So that's kind of an extraordinary near-death experience, but again, shows the subjectivity of fear. I mean, they're still conscious beings in a near-death experience. They're sort of like continuing the consciousness they had in their earthly life. And, you know, some things may frighten them that everybody else hearing their experience would say, well, that's unusual, I wouldn't be frightened. So that's subjectively frightening. There's objectively frightening. These are, best example would be hellish realms that are objectively frightening in the sense that there are malevolent, frightening beings. They may sense evil. They may visualize some evil. The scariest stuff I've ever read in my life is not, or seen in my life, is not scary movies, but it's the hellish realms described by these near-death experiencers. So that while they're out, while they do occur, I want to emphasize it's a little bit of a murky area of study. I was co-author of an article with a number of other near-death experiencers that came out within the last year in the Journal of the New York Academy of Sciences, and the principal author was looking at lots and lots of near-death. He was an intensive care unit doctor, so obviously around a lot of people that died or were resuscitated. And from his review of the literature, there was some uncertainty as to whether hellish near-death experiences even occurred because they're so rare. Now, in my over 4,000 near-death experiences I have, using a fairly high bar of evidentiality to, in other words, that to consider them within that study group of hellish NDEs, I'm still a little over 20 that I could find that seemed very convincing to me to be hellish NDEs and not confounding experiences, such as most common when being intensive care unit delirium, which is can be frightening experiences of people in the intensive care units for a long time. So based on that limited amount of evidence, it seems, first of all, a lot of people that are in these hellish realms, which are certainly frightening, a significant percentage of them simply ask to be removed. They may call out to a religious figure, to God, and they will generally be removed and removed promptly. My take on, and certainly some have very positive life changes. There's been a near-death experiencer that had a hellish experience that said that was what they needed, basically a spiritual kick in the pants to confront some issues in their life that they could not, would not have confronted otherwise. And so after these hellish NDEs, they don't really typically go about fearing death or fearing being in hell. They make positive life changes, and perhaps that was the only way that they could. I don't know of any other major near-death experience researcher that believes that there's a permanent involuntary hell. I don't want to emphasize that. So how do hell exist? And the people that describe these hellish realms during a near-death experience, of that little over 20 I've encountered, about half of them are only aware of hellish realms. When they're in, if you will, heavenly realms, typically with other spiritual beings. And the hellish realms that they visualize are very highly segregated from the rest of heaven. There seems to be barriers that keeps these, if you will, demonic within that barrier. And they don't, the demonic in the barrier is not interacting freely with the rest of, if you will, heaven, the afterlife, like everybody else. So that's important too. When people say hell could not possibly exist in heaven, that's technically correct based on that observation. And just to go the step further, it's I think people that end up in that in the hellish realms, given the overwhelming consistency of free will being of paramount importance in near-death experiences, I am suspicious that people that end up in hellish realms in the afterlife actually chose that. These are people that were unredeemably unapologetically evil, maintained that evil attitude towards others, and chose to be in a realm that they were comfortable with. I mean, they were with other demonic beings that shared their values, and that's why they chose to enter that hellish realm. To the demonic, the hellish realms is literally, in some twisted way, their heaven. So that's sort of the long-winded view of my take on hellish realms. And there's certainly other researchers with other ideas.
You talk about in the essay how people's perception is so much better when they're having a near-death experience. It's kind of like the physical brain is dumbing down our consciousness.
Yeah, that's a good way to look at it. I like that. The physical brain is kind of dumbing down our afterlife or real consciousness, if you will. A good example of what I cited in my essay was near-death experiences in the blind. I interviewed Vicky, who was born totally blind. To her, vision was unknown and unknowable, and Vicky was involved in a bad car wreck. And I always have to say when I discuss this, no, she wasn't driving, she was blind, but she was a professional singer, and then unfortunately an inebriated patron was driving her home at the end of the show and had a bad wreck. So the first time Vicky saw herself was when she was having an out-of-body experience. She was over her body, looking down at the body below, and was frightened at first because vision was so, well, it was the first time in her life and so unfamiliar. But after she calmed down, she became aware that body below had long hair. And interestingly, she recognized what she'd only known by the sense of feel, her hair, and interestingly, a ring her father gave her, known only by the sense of touch. And here, for the first time in her life, vision, correlating what she'd known by the sense of feel, was her down below. And she went on to have a stunningly detailed near-death experience with extensive vision. Now, for Vicky, interestingly, her vision is what many near-death experiencers describe, and that's 360-degree vision, which means she's simultaneously aware and processing the analogy of vision on Earth in front of her, back, right, left, up and down. Technically, it should be called spherical vision. And so that was when I told Vicky that All the rest of us in our earthly life have what's called pie-shaped visual fields because of the location of the eye in our skull and our limitation in seeing too far peripherally, and that we had pie-shaped fields. Vicky literally laughed at me and didn't believe it because, don't forget, her entire life experience with vision was spherical, and she simply could not understand how the rest of us did not have spherical vision as she did.
And you also talk about deaf people who could hear normally.
Right. One of the most detailed near-death experiences we ever got, we talked about the NDE scale. I've had like maybe 2 out of 4,000 that had a 32 on a 32, the top score. And one of them was Brian. He was, again, born deaf and communicated with sign language only, lip reading. So that's how he got through his whole life. And yet here he is during his near-death experience, having communication in the way virtually all people having near-death experiences do, and that's telepathic. In other words, he's received telepathic is, you know, again, a human word, but what's actually described in near-death experiences is sort of super telepathic in the sense that they convey not just thoughts, but also the context behind the thoughts, meaning they often describe the emotional context of whatever's being communicated, all extremely clear and with no possibility of ambiguity or error in communication whatsoever. So that's typically the telepathic communication that almost always happens in near-death experience. And Brian, there he is, born deaf totally, for the first time in his life, is aware of that telepathic communication, and he's communicating without doing sign language or reading lips. So again, another dramatic example of supernormal consciousness overcoming earthly handicaps.
And so what's this thing about people traveling through a tunnel in a near-death experience? Because I think it's one thing that skeptics say that's just vision getting messed up as the brain loses oxygen. But it's not every near-death experiencer that goes through a tunnel, is it?
No, it's a minority of people that have near-death experiences. Skeptics that believe tunnels and near-death experiences are like the visual field constricting as oxygen stops flowing to the brain have apparently never experienced diminished oxygen flowing to the brain and seeing what that's like. Medically speaking, I will tell you, if you have, you know, basically bump your head or have a traumatic event, you sort of start losing consciousness, losing full blood flow to the brain. When you have that, first and foremost, your consciousness is diminished. I mean, you're literally losing consciousness and you can hardly think at all. And the visual field actually constricts because the blood flow is diminished to the brain and is diminished to the visual cortexes and the retina of the eye that's involved with vision. So at that point in time, typically very diminished consciousness and just sort of light field constricting in. You don't see any details. Well, gosh, skeptics, contrast that to what people describe with overwhelming consistency in near-death experiences. They don't have constricting visual fields. They're typically more conscious and alert than they are in their earthly life. And tunnels can be very variably described as they typically pass through tunnels, usually very quickly. There may be details. They've been described as like bricks, patterns, doors, other beings in the tunnel, details far beyond what you would have if you were just simply having a constricted visual field as a result of hypoxia or decreased brain oxygen. Fortunately, for those that are claustrophobic, essentially never do we have anybody describe the tunnel as being claustrophobic.
And also, I suppose if you said to somebody, hey, I was in a tunnel yesterday, and they said to you, no, you were in a hospital bed and your sight was going, you'd think, well, I know if I'm in a tunnel, I was physically there.
Yeah, that's a really good point. We've actually had near-death experiencers as part of their entry into unconsciousness describe that constriction of their visual field. And then after that's done, then they're completely unconscious and then the near-death experience may progress. So it doesn't seem to be, again, people that experience both phenomena, tunnel and constricted vision as a result of hypoxia, it's obvious to them these are two completely different experiences.
Did you find the anesthesia-associated near-death experiences reported a tunnel more often?
Yeah, that was interesting. In that study, we looked at about several dozen this was an earlier study I did. At that time, we just had several dozen near-death experiences that very clearly occurred under adequate general anesthesia. And I compared 23 elements, or if you will, characteristics, what occurs during near-death experiences in responses to the survey question. So we compared those responses of what happens during a near-death experience during for those that had their near-death experience under anesthesia to those that had near-death experiences under all other circumstances. And 32 of the 33 elements were absolutely not statistically different between the two groups. But the only one statistically different, interestingly, was the tunnel. And that seemed to be statistically more often in those that had anesthesia. Now, that was an older study. I recall that I updated that data with a lot more anesthesia studies. And I think that statistical difference where they saw more tunnels, I believe that's dropped out in my more recent research. But I'd have to double check to be sure on that. There's no real good explanation for that. There is. Statistical significance is at the 5% level. That means one out of 20 times it would fall into that 5% difference between groups and be considered statistically different. So by the time you look at 33 different elements, it's not at all surprising that just out of random chance, one element, one of those 33 would be statistically significant. Because that's how statistics in chi-square works.
So could you tell us about, is it Sandy, and she met her deceased sister and also a neighbor that she didn't know was dead?
Yes, we've had near-death experiences. That's very uncommon, but maybe not really rare, is during the near-death experience, they may encounter other beings. Virtually all beings encountered in the near-death experience are deceased at the time of the near-death experience. So it's quite dramatic when a near-death experiencer encounters somebody they believe was alive, like their neighbor. They didn't know they died. And we've had a number of these types of near-death experiences. And it's only when they return from their near-death experience that they find out that and recover, that they find out that who they encountered in the near-death experience was actually deceased at the time of the near-death experience. There's two other flavors on that type of near-death experience, if you will. One, we have a small series of children that encountered during their childhood near-death experiences. And in their near-death experience, they encountered a deceased sibling that they never knew they had, a brother or a sister. And when they recover from what nearly killed them and tell their shocked parents, hey, I now know I have a brother or a sister. I met them and here's what they looked like. Invariably, when such experiences are reported, the gender is correct. The parents did not tell the child about either a brother or sister that died. And so they got the gender correct 100% of the time. Understand that parents are heartbroken when a child dies and may be reluctant to tell a young child about the fact that they had a sibling who died, often in infancy or before they were born, until the child is old enough to, in the parents' assessment, better understand death. 11, 12, 13 years old or so. So it's not at all unusual that parents won't tell their young children about the death of a sibling. So when they come back and tell the parents that, yes, I did have a brother or a sister that died and here's what they looked like, the parents are astounded, obviously, and every single time, both the physical description of the deceased sibling and the gender is correct. The other major flavor on encountering beings that they didn't know or died, it's so-called shared near-death experiences. These are very uncommon, but we have we're up to probably about 20 now. These are people that have two or more people have a simultaneous life-threatening event. And during their near-death experience, they're aware of each other that nearly died. They're unconscious at the same time. So they're aware of each other, see each other, and can interact with each other. And typically in these types of experiences, one goes on to permanent irreversible death and the other one recovers and can report a shared near-death experience, even if they're not aware the other person they saw in their near-death experience was dying at the same time they were.
And also with the very young children who have a near-death experience, they report all the same stuff that everybody else does?
Yeah, that's correct. So again, the same survey of the characteristics, what occurs during a near-death experience, I looked at this was in response to the skeptics that thought that near-death experiences were culturally determined. In other words, from that skeptic hypothesis, they say, well, obviously, you have a near-death experience based on what you would expect would happen during a near-death experience, which is bunk. And one of the better lines of evidence to refute that hypothesis are near-death experiences of very young children. So my study group was under 5 years old, and the average age of that group was actually 3.5 years old. Now, children that young have almost certainly not had well-formed conceptualizations about religion or an afterlife or death even, almost certainly don't know anything about a near-death experience or understand it. They're, if you will, practically culturally a blank slate. So I was quite amazed to find that even this group of very young children, comparing what happened during their near-death experience with all other near-death experiencers, older children and adult, there was no statistical difference between the, I believe it was 32 elements of the near-death experience we compared.
And also you say Dr. Grayson found that near-death experience accounts do not seem to be embellished or forgotten after nearly 20 years.
Yeah, that's an awesome study that Dr. Grayson reported. He was one of the original near-death experience researchers. So he had the ability to survey some near-death experiencers early on in his research using that NDE scale that we talked about. And he was able to find a group of these near-death experiencers, as you said, nearly 20 years later. So he asked them again, the NDE scale, exactly the same questions that he had typically over a decade ago. And remarkably, the response to the average NDE scale score was the same in that group, both when he originally did the survey and when he did it nearly 20 years later. So as Dr. Grayson correctly points out, as a group, near-death experiences don't seem to be embellished, added to, if you will, or forgotten, details forgotten over a long period of time. And this is all consistent with near-death experiences being a very special type of memory. We hear that over and over from near-death experiences, such as, I don't remember what I had for lunch a week ago, but I remember vividly in the finest detail the near-death experience I had 20 years ago. So near-death experiences seem to be, if you will, implanted, ingrained in the memory with a far greater accuracy than other earthly events around the time of the NDE.
The essay that you wrote that's a winner at the Bigelow Institute of Consciousness Studies, it was an essay winner there, and it's called Evidence for Survival of Consciousness in Near-Death Experiences, Decades of Science and New Insights. And I recommend it to everybody. You can get onto that website and download it or just read it on the website. It's fascinating.
And actually, I'm going to run with that a little bit, Simon. This was a huge essay with over $1 million in prize money that was done in 2021. Because of the huge prize money, the essay contest, by the way, was basically best scientific evidence of life after death, survival of consciousness. So because the prize money was so huge, they had over 1,000 people submitting essays, 25,000 word essays. I mean, heck, it's about half the size of a book. The panel of judges they had, there were 6 judges, were extremely knowledgeable and carefully picked to be the best in the world to assess scientific evidence of life after death. So what I shared on the podcast today, as remarkable as it sounds, is compiled largely from what I wrote up in that essay. And so I was in the runner-up group and won $50,000, and understand that what we just shared today was vetted by that 6 panels of judges as being some of the toughest peer review for evidentiality and scientific credibility that you're going to get for any scientific paper anywhere. And yet my essay made it past that, if you will, severe vetting process as being recognized as some of the strongest evidence of life after death. So what I'm saying just isn't my opinion. That's been the assessment of this carefully picked, knowledgeable, experienced panel of judges.
Like I said, everybody should read it. And thanks again for coming on the podcast. It's been fascinating.
Oh, great questions. Hey, it's been a real pleasure, Simon. Really enjoyed it.
And that was an interview with Jeffrey Long about his Bigelow Institute for Consciousness Studies winning essay. Evidence for Survival of Consciousness in Near-Death Experiences, Decades of Science and New Insights. And if you want to hear the rest of this fascinating interview, you can sign up to Patreon. When you sign up for $5 a month, you get an extended episode every week. And for $2 a month, you get an extended episode every month. And the Patreon episodes are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. And please check out my other podcast. It's called the Alien UFO Podcast, and I release new episodes every Monday, and you can find it on almost every podcast app. And I've also added a new tier to the Past Lives Podcast Patreon campaign, where for $12.50 a month, you can get the Alien UFO Podcast extended episodes every week, as well as the Past Lives Podcast extended episodes. And including the Alien UFO Podcast episodes, there are now more than 100 extended episodes available in the back catalogue. You can become a patron by going to patreon.com/pastlivespodcast or click on the Patreon button on my homepage at pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, and the links are in the show notes. And look out for the Past Lives Podcast episodes called Paranormal Stories, and they're released every Thursday. And there is a Past Lives Podcast Facebook group. If you'd like to join, you'd be very welcome. And if you enjoy the podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening. What have you learned about the perception of time passing? Because I've heard of near-death experiences saying that it lasted weeks or months, but they were only unconscious for 5 minutes.
Yes, that's not at all unusual. And that near-death experiencer, they're not alone. Many, many other near-death experiencers report that. We ask a survey question directly.